You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 5th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up in today's programme, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani makes a big speech at the weekend urging to end the country's isolation. Is this the rapprochement the West has been waiting for? Then we'll hear from the Foreign Desk, Monocle 24's Foreign Affairs programme. We'll be looking ahead at what the new year holds in store in the company of, amongst others, Fiona Wilson.
In recent months, China and South Korea have both been rather jointly ramping up these historical issues and talking about Japan's correct or incorrect attitude to history. And it's a huge kind of diplomatic struggle that's going on.
And later in the programme, we'll continue to look ahead, this time to a busy year of general elections. Today, we preview those slated to take place in Turkey with our Istanbul bureau chief, Joseph Dana.
If Erdogan is able to see his objectives realized and able to change the constitution, this will be one of the most important elections in the history of the Turkish Republic, and it will give him a four-year mandate to radically change the complexion of this country.
And with the giant consumer electronics show in Las Vegas firing up with its thousands of attendant booths and pavilions, we'll ask an expert in the field how to do sustainable temporary architecture. All that and plenty more besides coming up right here on The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. A busy show in prospect then. Before we start, let's get the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. A vessel involved in the search for the Air Asia Airbus that crashed into the Java Sea 8 days ago says it may have located the tail of the aircraft. It's the part of the plane that would contain the flight data recorders. Nine ships from four countries have converged on the crash site area, with teams of divers standing ready, but strong winds and high waves have hampered the operation. Speculation continues about the cause of the crash, with experts saying bad weather may have played a part. Aviation analyst Alistair Rottenshine told The Globalist that does make sense.
It is actually the fact that pilots do not routinely practice recovery from a stall at high altitude. But having said that, I think in a thunderstorm with jet upset, it would be very difficult to recover in any event. And this accident has very much the hallmarks of the Air Algerie 5017, which crashed in July 2014 in Mali, again through flying through a thunderstorm.
Airports across India have been placed on high alert after security officials received intelligence reports of a possible hijacking. It's thought that Air India received an anonymous telephone call threatening that a flight would be hijacked. The security alert comes ahead of India's annual Republic Day celebrations later this month, when the US President Barack Obama is due in the country. Two protesters have been shot dead in Bangladesh and scores injured in clashes between the ruling party and opposition activists. There had been fears of violence after the opposition leader refused a police call to cancel rallies planned in the capital, Dhaka. They're taking place to mark the first anniversary of last year's controversial election. A former Tunisian interior minister has been nominated as prime minister to form a new government after an agreement among political parties in the newly elected parliament. The nominee, Habib Assid, worked as interior minister after the 2011 revolution that ended Tunisia's one-party rule. His nomination follows the election of Beji Caid Essebsi as president. Former Taiwanese president Chen Shui-bian has been released from prison on a one-month parole for medical treatment. He's halfway through a 17-year jail term for corruption. The temporary release comes amid pressure from pro-independence opposition leaders who made significant gains in local elections 6 weeks ago. Firefighters continue to battle a bushfire in South Australia amid warnings that weather conditions are due to worsen over the coming days. At least 20 houses have been destroyed by the fire in the Adelaide Hills, with dozens of families having to live in temporary accommodation. Jay Wetherill is the Premier of South Australia.
We want it contained before the weather changes. We're expecting more hot weather, which will create conditions for the fire to escape, and we would like to contain it within its general perimeter.
One of Italy's most popular singer-songwriters, Pino Daniele, has died of a heart attack aged 59. Known for his fusion of the musical traditions of his native Naples with jazz and blues, Daniele played alongside the likes of Eric Clapton and Pat Metheny during his career. His band was also once the opening act for an historic concert in Milan by Bob Marley. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, David. More news from David Spencer at the bottom of the hour. Headlines coming your way at round about 12:30. 5 minutes past the hour here in London right now, 7:05 a.m. in New York City. This is The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. This is The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. Now, the pronouncements of Iran's President Hassan Rouhani are always met with a great deal of interest from observers around the globe. Those anticipating intrigue this past weekend will not have been disappointed, as the leader spoke about the dangers to his country's longer-term economic well-being posed by an isolationist position. And he stressed that foreign direct investment was a prerequisite for national security. On nuclear talks, Rouhani also explained that he perceived the key issue as being a matter of heart and willpower, rather than being about centrifuges. So what does all this mean? Joining us now on the line is David Patrikarakos. David is author of Nuclear Iran, The Birth of an Atomic State, and Associate Fellow in the School of Iranian Studies at the University of St. Andrews. David, thanks for joining us on the programme. What were your initial reactions to Rouhani's speech then? Do you think it's inaccurate to describe it as one of the most important that we've heard in recent times?
I would say it's the most important speech Rouhani has made since he became the president of Iran. What he did was several things. First of which was he threatened to call for a referendum, or he hinted rather at calling for a referendum. Now, he did not mention what issue the referendum would be on, but it was quite clear it would be on the nuclear issue. So he believes that he has the popular support of the people on this issue. And bear in mind, he is more flexible on the nuclear issue than Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, and indeed the hardline elements within the regime, including the Revolutionary Guard. The second thing he did is he attacked monopolies and entrenched business interests in the Iranian economy. Now, this is a direct, albeit veiled, attack on the Revolutionary Guard, who have now sort of soaked up large parts of the Iranian economy. So this is a very, very bold speech. It's a very direct speech, and it shows quite clearly that Rouhani is not going to take the attacks on his authority coming from the right lying down.
We'll talk a little bit more about the nuclear issue in a moment, David, but on the point about sort of this isolationist position and the importance of foreign direct investment, how does that rhetoric play to his constituents then, to people in Iran? Are they ready for that sort of rhetoric?
I think so. I mean, this is very, very interesting, because what you have to understand is that one of the fundamental ideological linchpins of the Islamic Republic is this idea of self-reliance. It's enshrined in the constitution. Now, the Shah, who was overthrown by Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979, was seen as a lapdog of the Americans. So when the Ayatollahs came in, they shut Iran off. They said, now we are self-sufficient. Now we are only rely on ourselves. We will never be a lapdog for Western imperial interests again. The fact that he's saying now that we need to lessen this isolation without lessening our sort of independence is hugely significant, because on one level, it strikes at the very heart of what the Islamic Republic is supposed to stand for. However, because of years of economic mismanagement, and Ahmadinejad, to get his international decisions, was an appalling domestic economic manager. Iran is in serious financial trouble, and what he says makes economic sense, and there are an increasing amount of people in Iran that understand this. And bear in mind, the Iranians are very educated. So I think people, yes, Rouhani was elected to lessen international isolation, and I think the Iranian people do want it.
What do we think about this nuclear issue then? You mentioned this idea of a referendum of sorts. He talked so much about it being a matter of heart and a matter of conscience. Were you surprised by his position on that?
I mean, what he said specifically was, you know, hearts and wills matter more than centrifuges. Now, this is hugely significant, because the big sticking point between Iran and the P5 plus one, that's the five security powers plus Germany, has been the amount of centrifuges. Now, in calling for a referendum, this is a very skillful political move, because what it would do is it would allow, theoretically, Ayatollah Khamenei to save face. because he could say, if the referendum went the way that Rouhani wanted it to say, more flexibility, he could say, well, I'm just following the will of the people, as I've always done, or rather, you know, something other nonsensical like that. So I think this is very, very important, because it shows, this is the clearest signal yet, that he wants to fulfill his promise of lessening international isolation. And this is a clear sign to the international community as well that Iran is willing to compromise, or that Rouhani wants to compromise. This is hugely significant.
David, let me ask you as well about what Rouhani had to say about the economy more specifically. You already mentioned this idea of it being monopolized by the government. He said, we will not prosper as long as that's the case. We must see more competition. He talked about bringing in transparency and that enabling a fight against corruption. Noble sentiment indeed, but does he have the facility to actually do those kinds of things?
Well, this is the very big question. I mean, a lot of Iran is a lot of Iranian domestic politics. I mean, it's riven with factionalism. A lot of it is rhetoric. Now, whether or not he has it, I can't honestly say. However, he must think that he's got a pretty good shout at it, because it'd be suicidal to say what he has said if he didn't think he had a chance of following through on it. But it's going to be the toughest task. The most powerful entity in Iran at the moment is no longer the mullahs, it is the Revolutionary Guard. And ironically, it was Rafsanjani, who's become somewhat of a critic of the government, the former prime minister, who let them into the economy. And the car manufacturing industry, oil industry, the Revolutionary Guard, I mean, they essentially control all of these industries. Rouhani is essentially threatening to take on the most powerful people in Iran.
Thank you very much indeed, David, for joining us. That was David Patrick Karakos. Up next on The Briefing, we're setting our sights on Russia. Amid the diplomatic wrangling between the West and Russia over the latter's military manoeuvres in Ukraine, another crisis, or at least tensions, seem to be brewing. Just days ago, the United States launched an experimental blimp over the country's capital. The purpose? To identify incoming cruise missiles. There are only a few guesses as to where those missiles might come from. Washington's showed increasing signs of wariness of patrols by Russian subs, which can carry nuclear-capable cruise missiles. It's also concerned about Russia's testing of a medium-range cruise missile, claiming Russia is violating a 1987 treaty. For his analysis on a potential flare-up between these former nuclear rivals, we're joined now by David Herzenhorn, New York Times Moscow correspondent. David, thanks for joining us on The Briefing. Is this a sort of a flare-up of the sort of nuclear rivalry that we associate more closely with the sort of end days of the Cold War?
Certainly this is part of this renewed Cold War rivalry that we've seen intensify following Russia's intervention in Ukraine, the annexation of Crimea. It's one of the more alarming aspects of the fight, the dispute, disagreement, beginning even last March when Dmitry Kislyov, one of now the senior advisors to President Putin on media affairs, he's in charge of a wide range of government-controlled media resources these days, went out in public and wanted to remind everyone that Russia is the one country that could still turn the United States into radioactive dust. That was his phrase. When you combine that kind of bombastic rhetoric with allegations, as you said, that Russia has violated an important intermediate-range missile treaty, that brings a lot of concern. There's no question about it.
So the bombast is worrying then. What about the chances of, real retrogressive steps? We talk about, you know, the US wanting to potentially redeploy its own cruise missiles within Europe as a response. This is something, obviously, that we haven't seen for, what, nearly a quarter of a century now. We surely couldn't see that happening, could we?
Well, what we've seen is that even as the two nations were making quite a lot of progress on arms control, which in fact was a major priority of President Obama and President Medvedev when they were working on their reset, which seems quite a long time ago, but really was not that very long ago at all. What we have seen is this intensifying rhetoric, as you say. Whether it translates into anything real, no one believes that. No one believes that Russia and the United States should really be enemies from a national security perspective at this point. Obviously, the dispute in Ukraine has changed a lot of that thinking. We've seen Russian Air Force jets in areas where they weren't expected, submarines, as you mentioned, crossing into the Atlantic, Sweden at one point looking for a Russian sub that they believe they had detected crossing into their waters. So this is certainly all worrisome in the context, again, of what is a hot war on the ground in eastern Ukraine.
And David, what about Barack Obama on all this? Because, of course, people will recall his commitment to address arms control, this idea of rolling back on strategic nuclear warheads. The numbers, though, say something very different. They actually, the numbers deployed by the US and Russia actually went up last year. We know they're spending billions of dollars, modernizing their weapons arsenals. How disappointing is this? And how disappointed do you think people will be in Obama specifically, given he made this something of an early priority?
I would suspect that Obama is the most disappointed of all. I mean, nuclear nonproliferation was a major priority for him, and it's one of the reasons that I think he kept coming back and back again in attempting to rebuild the relationship with Vladimir Putin, thinking that, you know, even as cooperation was falling apart in many other areas, if you remember, the Magnitsky Act was passed seeking to punish human rights violators in Russia. Russia then banned adoptions of Russian orphans by Americans. Even after many of these diplomatic kerfuffles, Obama was coming back hoping that there would be some historic move forward to further reduce nuclear arms. Now, each of those presidents has been dealing with hawks back home who remember very well the Cold War and have been insisting on modernizing the existing nuclear arsenals even as cuts were made. So you have that dual situation where there are both agreements to and have been treaties to reduce nuclear arms while billions being spent to increase the weapons that exist. That's part of the domestic politics that unfortunately seems to be toxic and playing into this, where the old Cold Warriors continue to insist that domestically, for national security purposes, maintaining and building these arsenals is important.
David, thanks very much for joining us. That was David Herzenhorn, New York Times Moscow correspondent. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll be in Tunisia. Stay tuned.
Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture on Monocle 24 is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you never knew you wanted to know about, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 culture shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24.
You're with The Briefing on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. The new Tunisian president today suggested that Habib Asid, former Ben Ali official and minister, should become the new prime minister and start forming a government. Asid still needs to be voted in by parliament and form a government, but it would mean that the three most senior positions in the country, that of president, president of parliament and prime minister, are filled by ex-regime officials nevertheless. So does this threaten the so-called sole success story of the Arab Spring before its democracy has really taken root? Well, I'm joined now by Monocle's Tunis correspondent, Navina Kotour. Navina, tell us, first of all, about this individual, the prime minister who's been nominated. Tell us a little bit about who exactly Asid is.
Yes, it's been announced today by the parliamentary president and by the president's office that they think Habib Asid would be a good candidate to become the next prime minister. He was an agriculture minister. He served in the interior ministry. He also was in place in the Ben Ali cabinet when the regime fell. He then served again as interior minister in an interim government, and he has advised the first freely elected government in Tunisia. So his opponents are pointing to the fact that he's the official in the interior ministry that has been involved in torture and human rights abuses. His supporters are pointing to his political experience and saying that he was trusted after the revolution happened and in the first government as well. So I think we have to wait and see. But for especially young people, this is quite a disconcerting appointment.
Well, and I guess one of the things, Navina, that makes it all the more disconcerting is the fact that, you know, he would not be alone in having links to this old regime. I mentioned in the introduction that the president and parliamentary president, how concerned do you think people are about, if not the practicalities of that, about the message that sends out?
I think it depends a bit on who you talk to and what's the priority for people here. People who do care about judicial reform, who do care about the reform of the security services and the administration, are saying that the president, Bejikhaire Dessepsi, was a senior official, was actually interior minister in the first autocratic regime here after independence. He established a police state. He is partially, according to them, responsible for some of the torture that happened here. But he is the president. Then you have the parliamentary president, who was a minister of communication in the Ben Ali regime. He, people would say he was a minister of discommunication in the regime. So he doesn't have a strong track record when it comes to freedom of information, access to information. And then you have this man. And I think we do have to wait and see what happens. But it is not a very encouraging sign that the people who are being appointed don't really seem to signal a sort of turning of the page, but more of a sort of turning back the clock.
Well, let me just ask you then, Navina. I mentioned in the introduction this idea about, you know, Tunisia is very much a success story of the Arab Spring, if you like, this democracy taking root. Do you think that the appointment of these individuals, if indeed Abid's appointment is confirmed, could undermine that? Is there a genuine fear there that, you know, there's a new constitution, there have been free elections in the 3 years since the uprising? Does it risk losing that momentum because of the involvement of these characters?
I think it does actually risk losing the momentum, but we have to wait and see. It's something I have been putting to a lot of people here, and people are pointing to the fact that now, compared to before 2011, there is an unprecedented level of scrutiny, international scrutiny, media scrutiny, and you know, there are a lot of civil society organizations watching what these politicians who have been elected are doing. And they're also pointing to the fact that some of these people who were quite senior within the previous regime, and, you know, you and I said links to the previous regime, I was just corrected by someone saying they were actually members of the previous regime. So that they were the more moderate voices within the previous regime, that the president actually did try to push for multi-party elections. So I think we have to sort of wait and see, but it's definitely not a sort of fresh start.
Navina, let me just ask you briefly about, we've seen some sporadic violence in the country over the past sort of few days, over the last week or so. Are these any more than sort of isolated flare-ups, or do you think there is a worry that, you know, there could be a worsening of violence if indeed people are not satisfied with the appointments that they're seeing?
I think for now these are quite isolated flare-ups, but most people here, most observers, seem to think that unless the sort of economic demands that came to the forefront during the revolution are not answered, and there's not a sense that this government is actually taking these issues in the interior of the country, unemployment, the lack of services, seriously, that these protests that we saw in 2011 could well return. And I spoke to someone who said that he thinks that the honeymoon period for this government will be very short. It will have 3 months, maybe slightly longer. And then the population really expects them to start delivering and to start working. So I think, you know, for now, these are isolated flare-ups, but there's a great sense of division between the south of the country, the interior of the country, where the revolution started, and the north of the country, that has just elected Nida Tunis to be, you know, in the presidency as well as in parliament.
Navina, thanks very much as always. That was Monocle's Tunis correspondent Navina Kator joining us on the programme. You're with The Briefing here on Monocle 24. It is 12:24 exactly here in London, 7:24 a.m. in Washington, D.C. Joining us now with today's North American newspapers at the ready is Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Steve, welcome. Freshly back. You're looking suspiciously suntan for a man in chilly London.
Well, indeed. It is a little bit dreary here in London, but yeah, you know, a couple of weeks away, somewhere slightly warmer. But very nice to be back, and Happy New Year to you too, Tom. Should we begin with the LA Times?
Yeah, let's go to the West Coast.
Okay, so good news, good news, good news. Work starting on the bullet train is the headline on the front of the Los Angeles Times. Construction begins tomorrow in Fresno on the first 29-mile segment of the $68 billion fast train. Fantastic news, isn't that, Tom?
If it happens, Steve.
Yeah, exactly. If it happens. The first paragraph of this story is great. Then it reminds you that there's been 2 years of court challenges to the project. Then it also goes on to tell you that rail officials haven't actually yet lined up the funds needed to complete the initial system over the next 14 years. Construction is starting 2 years later than the state had promised, and acquisition of private property is going slower than expected. There's also all sorts of legal agreements that still haven't been sorted out. So, sort of good news.
Steve, it seems to me I'm unlikely to be travelling on the bullet train possibly
ever
within my lifetime.
It is quite possible. It's a real shame that it's taken so long, but we'll see where it goes. You know, at least there is some political support, and Governor Jerry Brown of California is very enthusiastic about this project. Obviously not everyone else is in the state is, but we reckon it's,
or federally either. One wonders whether the Republicans will be happy to
put
their hands in their pockets.
Where else should we go? Boston Globe here. Intense scrutiny of jurors starts today. This is about the trial that's going to begin. This is the long first phase of the trial for the man accused of bombing the Boston Marathon 2 years ago, Jocker Tsarnaev, a 21-year-old who is going to be standing trial. Prosecutors and defence lawyers will start whittling down a list of more than 1,200 names today, aiming to find 12 jurors and 6 alternates capable of deciding whether Tsarnaev is guilty, and if so, whether he should face the death penalty. So it's taken 2 years for this trial to go ahead, and as I say, this is going to be a very sort of tricky, delicate period.
One remembers the details of the case. Of course, it was absolutely harrowing. And then you just think of this long, drawn-out process. You always forget that jury selection in the US is such a laborious process, particularly in such a high profile case as this.
Exactly. And it's going to be, I think they're saying testimony is planned to begin next month, February. But it's going to be, it's going to be very, very difficult. And they're going to need a unanimous decision. But obviously that is a long way ahead.
Story to watch, rather, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Shall we switch back? Maybe, I don't know, New York Times? There was a picture on New York Times. I don't know if you saw this one, Steve, that caught my attention. Do you see these two people scaling the Dawn Wall on El Capitan, a sheer granite mountain face? They're scaling it without rope assistance. Look at that.
Oh, I don't know about
in
that.
In Yosemite, don't they look completely... I wonder whether that's what you've been doing.
That was my holiday.
Why you're so sun-kissed.
It would also sort of have aged me by about 20 years, I think, if I tried to do that. Yeah, this is a story about battling up a sheer Yosemite face, seizing a dream, not a rope. There we are. It's the New York Times, there are two commas in that headline.
I like how they do that.
Really? No?
A bit of a, maybe more of a US
story. Well, here's another headline with a comma on it. As seen on TV, novelizations sustain fans and gain respect. This is a story by Alexandra Alter about how there are now more and more novels based on TV shows. You know, it used to be the way that people would write a novel and then a TV company would buy up the rights, and then you'd see that novel, your favourite novel, come out again with a new cover on with the stars of it saying, now a major TV series. Well, actually now a lot of very successful TV drama series are going the other way and commissioning novels based on the characters, the setup, the environment of the TV series. So a new crime novel has just come out called Bratva, which is based on the FX show Sons of Anarchy. There's also been novels based on Homeland by Fringe, which is a sci-fi series by J.J. Abrams. And of course, Britain's very own Broadchurch, which was a crime series that was on TV here in the UK and also did rather well internationally. They're now having novels as well. Any that you'd like to have a novelised version of?
I disagree with it in principle.
Really?
Yeah, I think it should be the written word first, Steve. I'm a traditionalist like that.
You don't think The Wire, the novel, would be quite good?
Well, we kind of touched upon that, didn't we?
Yeah.
With the, what was it, Clockers. I felt like that's almost like the novel of...
Yeah.
Remember that book?
No, I don't remember that. No. Anyway.
Lost you already. that's our Steve Bloomfield with his review of the North American newspapers. And this is The Briefing.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
It's exactly 12:30 here in London. You're listening to The Briefing. There's plenty still to come on today's programme, including doing the business with our friends at Bloomberg. Before that, though, let's do the news. Here's David Spencer with the headlines.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. The captain of an Indonesian Navy vessel has found what could be the tail of the crashed Air Asia Airbus. It comes 8 days after the aircraft crashed into the Java Sea in bad weather. Ships and aircraft scouring the area for debris and bodies have widened their search to allow for the influence of currents. An emergency meeting of the Arab League is taking place to discuss the crisis in Libya. Hundreds of civilians have died in violence since August, since rival groups intensified fighting for control of the country. Lebanon has tightened entry requirements for Syrians as it tries to stem the flow of refugees, with more than a million already in the country. From today, Lebanese authorities will require that Syrians at the border provide the purpose and length of their stay. Two Saudi border guards have been killed on the frontier with Iraq in what's thought to be the militant group Islamic State's first assault on the kingdom. The suicide bomb and gun attack happened early on Monday. More than 1,000 potential jurors are due to report to federal court in Boston from today as selection begins for the trial of the man accused of the Boston Marathon bombing. Jorkar Tsarnaev faces the death penalty over the 2013 attack, which killed three people and injured more than 250 others. He's pleaded not guilty to all 30 charges against him. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. Spencer, more news from David at the top of the hour, 1300. Your next full bulletin of world news here on the station. 12:32 here in London, 7:32 in New York. To whence we head now. Joining us, our regular voice from Bloomberg's New York office, the ever-wise Pim Fox is with us. Pim, thanks for being on the programme. Let's talk a little bit about, the euro weakening. Unprecedented lows, but lows we've not seen for a while because of what we're seeing in Greece.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, that's the headline, right? I mean, you can say that there's some negative piece of news, mainly because of Greece, because of the upcoming elections, whether the Greeks will remain in the European Union and so on. Whatever the reason, the fact is that the euro right now is trading at 1.19 to the U.S. dollar. That's down about 0.9%. That's just today. The dollar getting stronger as the euro gets weaker. That means that, a lot of different things happen. First of all, you see a lot of capital and a lot of money start to flow into the United States, particularly into U.S. Treasury bonds, because you can earn a higher rate of interest in the United States by buying U.S. government debt than you can by investing in German government debt using euros. So you're going to see more fund flows into the United States. A weakening euro also means that crude oil, which is priced in dollars, is going to get more expensive for Europeans just at the time when their economies, particularly those in France, Italy, and in Spain, are suffering from a combination of recession and deflation. So if you're looking to make a holiday in the eurozone, this is a good time to do so. But unfortunately for those businesses that are in the eurozone, they're going to have to work extra hard to increase their exports to an already slowing global economy.
Now, you mentioned oil in passing there, Pim. Let's talk about Brent crude prices, because we're way down to levels we haven't seen for, nearly 6 years.
55, man. I mean, how about that? You want 55 bucks for a barrel of crude oil. Now, that's not going to give you all that much. I mean, a barrel of crude probably turns into somewhere in the area of about 19 U.S. gallons when it comes to refined gasoline. And I won't go into the details, the complexity of the gasoline and crude markets and so on. Suffice it to say that There was one quote this morning from traders saying we have irrational exuberance to the downside, meaning that the consensus is there's no rational reason why crude oil is at $55, but it is. And as a result, you are seeing a scramble for assets in the United States. That'll come when the producers, natural gas producers, crude oil producers, when they are faced with the prospect of not being able to produce a profitable well at $55 a barrel. It costs you more to get it out of the ground than it is to sell it. So the ramifications will be large, although the United States is somewhat lucky because much of what we're talking about isn't necessarily going to hit natural gas in the same way. Natural gas is unnaturally cheap in the U.S.
That could be a good news story then, potentially a little further down the line. I wonder about what the future holds, though, for some of the kids, Pim, who sleep with their smartphones, because I gather this could be it could be bad news for them. Am I right in thinking this?
You know what I love is your smooth segue. No, I understand. It is. I mean, these are the sort of the top fun stories. But this is kind of serious, I guess. And you could say, boy, you know, one of the unintended consequences of electricity, which of course comes not only from hydro, but also, you know, from natural gas and so on. But having cheap electricity, being tethered to our electronic products, there is a study that has been released, and it takes a look at children aged between 9 and 12 years old. And the study suggests it's going to be published in a magazine called Pediatrics, and it says that children who sleep in the same room as these small screens, such as your iPhone and your Android device, get almost 21 fewer minutes of shut-eye a night than those who didn't. And then, you know, you have the consequences of lack of sleep and less sleep and so on. I mean, obviously, this has been going on since they invented the electric light bulb. But be that as it may, maybe you ought to just check and see at least how many hours your children are glued to a small screen every day. And apparently, because the screens are smaller and you hold them closer to your face, to your eyes, production of melatonin is disrupted even more. So it causes children to have more difficulty going to sleep. So there's no free lunch with any of the technology.
This sounds scary, Pim. And I know I've read other studies about kids getting super developed thumbs because of playing with these phones. I'm worried about what the future holds for all these poor kids out there.
Well, as long as you can have one that does it better than everybody else, I guess you're okay. But, I mean, maybe we'll just... Actually, they don't have thumbs, right? As you said, maybe they'll just be born with thumbs and paddles. Maybe that's the future. I don't know.
This is a whole new program strand we could get into, Pim. Let me ask you about something you're talking about.
It would be like GMO food will be next,
exactly.
I'm afraid.
Thumbs up.
I want to know about London Bankers.
Well, I was going to say, you're talking about kids there who are being kept up at night by their smartphones. I guess people are kept up at night worrying about, you know, the job market and what opportunities are out there. But vacancies in the financial sector up significantly in the last 12 months.
Yeah, well, see, I did this for you because I want you to have that fallback position. You know, I want you to, you know, always have in the back of your mind that, you know, maybe you know, you can take the tube out to Canary Wharf. Anyway, job vacancies in the financial services industry, as you said, in London jumped, 18%? All right, let's say 20%. This means that, you know, if you are looking for a job in the finance business, means that... you know, you're going to be in a better position than you were probably last year. Now, the issue remains that, you know, one person has to leave before another person takes the job, but it is a big improvement over 2013, and it means that people feel a little bit more positive and economic about their own prospects so that they can leave one job to perhaps take the job someone else. But what you see is a change in the way that bonuses are paid out and really a change in nature of the industry itself. But nevertheless, you know, you thought that there would never be another job in Canary Wharf or in the City of London. Think again, the vacancy rate is up 18%.
I'm quite happy here in Marylebone for the time being, Pim. We'll leave it there. Pim Fox from Bloomberg in New York, thanks as always for joining us. A terrific roundup of some of the big stories in the world of business this day. You're with The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Broadcasting around the clock from our headquarters at Midori House in London, Monocle 24 is the global radio service of Monocle magazine and a wholly owned subsidiary of Wing Content. With bureau in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Istanbul, Zurich, New York and Toronto, and a network of over 35 correspondents, Monocle 24 is edited by Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck, Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards. If you have any editorial, programming or advertising inquiries, please contact us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Coming up to 12:42 here in London, that'll be 8:42 a.m. in Sao Paulo. Now, this weekend on the Foreign Desk, our editors and correspondents sat down for a round table to discuss the year ahead, the big challenges in 2015 in foreign policy and politics. Today we hear from our Tokyo Bureau Chief, Fiona Wilson, along with our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears, in conversation with Steve Bloomfield.
I think there's going to be an interesting triangular relationship between China, Japan and South Korea. You know, the 70th anniversary of the end of the war is coming up. And I mean, in recent months, China and South Korea have both been rather jointly ramping up these historical issues and talking about Japan's correct or incorrect attitude to history. And it's a huge kind of diplomatic struggle that's going on. And I think that will probably be rather magnified by that particular anniversary. So that could be interesting. And, it's a huge block to relations improving the different attitudes to what happened during the war. So I think that's going to be one of the big issues for the coming year.
And that obviously is going to affect not just its relationships with China, but with South Korea as well. I mean, of those two, I mean, South Korea and China are, you know, don't necessarily always see eye to eye on a number of issues. But when it comes to, you know, commemorating the war, they may have much in common here.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think President Park has been, she's been quite implacable about these issues. I think Shinzo Abe was hoping that she would be more aligned with him on some issues, but she's turned out to be a rather frostier neighbour than he was expecting. And he really has got nothing from her. She's been, I think, really playing to a domestic audience until the issue of the comfort women is resolved in some way to South Korea's satisfaction. I think she can't really be shown to be warm towards Japan. So, yeah, that's been quite a challenge in the past year, and I think that's going to continue into 2015.
Aisha Spears, last week we spoke about the protests in Hong Kong and, you know, what may or may not happen in the year ahead. Looking more broadly at the region, the ASEAN region, what do you think are going to be the key themes to pick out in 2015?
Well, I mean, it's a case of everybody and nobody is talking about the formation of this economic community, which has been pledged to be formed in 2015. I think key to highlight is that it's by December 31st, 2015, not January 1st. There's a lot of scepticism about this economic community for a number of reasons. Many people are picking up on kind of the disparate nature of the nations involved, comparing the GDP of a country like Cambodia with something like Singapore, and Singapore, you know, is seeing economic growth. through 2015, that's obviously going to be a problem. Awareness is another issue. Few people are really talking about this creation of a community. It took the EU a good 50 years to make what it did.
And also, you know, the EU, or the, you know, when it began as the European Coal and Steel Community, it was, firstly, you just had this horrendous war for the second time in a generation. But these countries were also democracies.
Right. And I think that we have a number of countries who are recent democracies. We've got countries that are already seeing their own issues between them. We've discussed issues of the South China Sea, and China would not be involved in this. But this is obviously a contentious thing if the ASEAN economic community wants to be working with China. There's very little funding of ASEAN. There's not a huge number of people employed. And a very basic issue is that the language would be English. And it's not a region that really is going to be very coherent in English.
Fiona, one issue which we probably can't ignore for 2015 is North Korea. Incredibly hard to predict. Even when we've just seen what's happened, we're not entirely sure what's happened. This could be, like every year, a really important year for North Korea, and not just its impact on, you know, its government's impact on its own people, but on the wider region and the world.
I mean, you know, North Korea continues to astound. The fact that it still exists, you know, it just shouldn't exist. It's a sort of extraordinary anomaly. And I think, you know, say from Japan's perspective, this ongoing battle about the abduction issue, this extraordinary situation where Japanese citizens were abducted by North Korea in the 70s and 80s, it's still a very ongoing issue. It's a very live issue in Japan. It's never been resolved. You know, Japan has tried everything. It's eased sanctions, much to the annoyance of its compatriots like the US, who didn't really want it to do that. But they said, no, this issue of abductions has to be resolved. You know, North Korea is on its doorstep. People aren't very clear about what its nuclear ambitions are. And, you know, really nobody knows. Kim Jong-un disappeared for a while, emerged with a limp and generally sitting down wherever possible. So there's all sorts of speculation about gout. You know, but really, it's just this extraordinary mystery that continues.
And it's interesting as well, Fiona, that while reunification has for a long time been popular in South Korea as an idea, for younger generations, it's seen as perhaps not as important as it used to be.
No, I think there was a great sentimentality among an older generation, which still exists. It's very complicated, the idea of reunification at this point. You know, China really in many ways wouldn't support the reunification. Does it want a massive, powerful Korea on its doorstep? There's a lot of speculation about how much China really wants that to happen. So I think there are many other factors at play there, keeping the reunification from happening.
Aisha Spears, in China, is the big issue the economy? It's certainly, you know, on paper, you know, you can look at the growth figures and go, well, this isn't bad at all. You know, 7% or 6.5% or whatever it is we really think, you know, that's not bad. But for a country like China, it is bad, isn't it?
I don't think it's bad. I think it's just this acceptance of, I think, what they're calling the new normal. So understanding that their economy is changing, that their workforce is different. You can't rely on cheap labour in the same way. Obviously, they want to develop their workforce to a more skilled level. One of the interesting things that people are obviously talking about is the Shanghai free trade zone. There's the Shanghai Hong Kong exchange. Many people in Hong Kong feel a little bit nervous about how Shanghai will eventually overtake Hong Kong. All the kind of finance investment, intelligence will be in Shanghai. Foreign companies will want to relocate to mainland China rather than Hong Kong.
That was our Hong Kong Bureau Chief Aisha Spears and our Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson in conversation with Steve Bloomfield on this weekend's Foreign Desk. You can hear that and all our other great shows anytime at monocle.com via iTunes or SoundCloud. You're listening to The Briefing right now on Monocle 24. Almost 14:49 in Cairo, 12:49 here in London. It'll be 7:49 in Washington, D.C. Time for our series. This week we're looking at some of the most significant general elections taking place in the course of the new year. We begin in Turkey, which is getting prepared for June's parliamentary elections. If President Erdogan's AK party manages to secure itself a landslide victory, that will give him a clear mandate and a further 4 years to change Turkey. Many already suspect that redrafting the Turkish constitution is on his to-do list. A little earlier on The Globalist, Emma Nelson and Victoria Graham caught up with Monocle's Istanbul bureau chief, Joseph Dana. They began by asking him if it's assumed that the elections will indeed be a landslide for President Erdogan and his party.
Well, it's not naturally assumed that it's going to be a landslide, but all indicators point to the fact that Erdogan will be able to complete his kind of political objectives. This election in 2015 is going to be the summation of Erdogan's plan going forward, basically giving himself the necessary mandate, the power to change, to ratify the Turkish constitution, and effectively switch or shift Turkey to a more kind of presidential system. It's a very similar shift that, as to what happened in Russia, basically solidifying power in Erdogan's hands. Now, the primary issue is going to be reaching this 330-seat mandate of a 550-seat parliament. In the last election, the AK party came to 312 seats. And so if it has similar results, the AK party is going to have some very interesting alliances with some other parties in the Turkish political spectrum. And by all accounts, it looks like Erdogan's trying to build bridges with the pro-Kurdish HDP party of all parties. And it looks like we're going to see this actually come into reality. But, you know, the election is in June, so some things could change in that time.
Is it definitely going to be in June? I heard earlier that it could be in May, possibly.
Well, my feeling is that it will be in June, and Erdogan is going to stick to this plan. Like I said, this is not an election that is happening in a vacuum. One could argue that this is an election that Erdogan's been thinking about, or at least the AK party has been thinking about, for the last decade. And this is really the summation. I don't like to be that grand when talking about Turkish politics, but if Erdogan is able to see his objectives realized and able to change the constitution, this will be one of the most important elections in the history of the Turkish Republic. And it will give him a 4-year mandate to radically change the complexion of this country. We've seen these little dabblings with, you know, moving more towards a kind of Islamic social agenda, talking about bringing Ottoman Turkish back into the curriculum. These kinds of very socially conservative things could actually come into power or into reality if Erdogan's able to just secure this victory and have 4 years of basically no opposition and complete control of Turkey, as it were.
Erdogan's policies have been incredibly divisive, and an awful lot of the media has been suppressed as a result of what's been happening. To what degree do you think that this election battle will actually expose much deeper schisms in the Turkish social fabric?
Well, those schisms have been coming out, especially in the last 2 years. It started with the Gezi Park protest movement in Istanbul, and we've seen constant, kind of social schisms, as you're talking about, unfold. But it hasn't translated into real political opposition in this country, and that's really what the problem is in terms of Erdogan, solidifying power and doing whatever he wants. And so the CHP, the main opposition party, is essentially, and I hate to use this word, feckless when it comes to combating Erdogan's incredible political capital. And by all accounts, that's what's going to continue. Now, if he reaches 312 seats in this election as opposed to 330, it really won't matter, because he's such a cunning politician that that this goal of solidifying power, rewriting the constitution, and effectively creating a kind of sultanship for himself is in sights. And this is what we're going to see happen in 2015.
That was Monocle's Istanbul bureau chief, Joseph Dana, with Emma Nelson and Victoria Graham on this morning's Globalist. You can hear part two of our series looking at the big elections of 2015 here on The Briefing at the same time tomorrow on Monocle 24. Seven minutes before 1300 here in London, and you're listening to The Briefing. Now, the giant consumer electronics show in Las Vegas is firing up with its thousands of attendant booths and pavilions. But what principles govern the creation, construction, and eventual dismantling of these edifices? And what kind of environmental cost results from such features? Let's hear from an expert in the field of architecture, in particular, how to do a sustainable temporary architecture and do it rather well, I'm sure he won't mind us saying. Joining us now is David Morley from David Morley Architects here in London. David, thank you very much for being on The Briefing on Monocle 24. We'll talk a bit more about some of your most noteworthy temporary projects in a moment. But firstly, just in that sort of point of principle, does it worry you as an architect and someone presumably who's very involved in counting the environmental cost of construction of any kind, that these big consumer shows, for example, create a lot of buildings, booths, pavilions that are there for sometimes only a matter of days, and there's not a great deal of concern, it seems at times, about what happens to them after that.
Well, no, I think it's a very exciting challenge, and I think there are some great examples of how you can deliver these sort of temporary structures in a way which is much more sustainable than by using permanent infrastructure.
Well, David, tell us some of those secrets then. I mentioned your own tremendous successes. We think back, of course, here in London to the sort of water polo arena in the Olympic Park in 2012. What kind of principles do you use to govern then those sorts of projects, and maybe even more short-term ones than that?
Well, I think what is notable, if you look at the legacy of the London Olympics, is that there is no acres of unused buildings and extent of tarmac. The temporary buildings have been taken away, and all that space is going to be used for urban regeneration. So the key is doing that in a sustainable way, because a temporary building has to obey all the laws of a permanent building in terms of weather tightness, in terms of bad weather. But you can, first of all, do it in a way which is where you can reuse all the components, so that afterwards nothing is thrown away. All the components of the buildings are reused, and I think there's a real potential to think of temporary buildings as a kit of parts, which can be used again and again, rather like a pop festival.
Well, that's an interesting notion, David. I wonder, let me ask you a bit about the sort of the theory then when it comes to this, because you already alluded to this, the sort of the challenge of creating something in a very dynamic way. Do you think that is more appealing to architects, or is there a school of thought, I don't know, maybe a traditionalist school of thought, who says, well, look, I'm only really interested in investing a great deal of resources in things that will be there, you know, for the duration, that will stand the test of time? Or do you think that certainly, you know, in the contemporary world, the challenges are such that all the great architects need to also engage with these temporary challenges as well?
I think every building has a lifespan to it, and we can look at pop-ups, which might be there for a few weeks, through to buildings that are there for a year, through to buildings that might be there for 20 years as part of a regeneration process. And the excitement of it, I think, is that there's some things you can do when you know your building's not going to be permanent. You can look at some materials which might have a shorter lifespan. For the Olympic Games, we developed a new material called phthalate-free PVC, and that's an incredibly versatile and cheap material which you can recycle, which was developed specifically for the London 2012 Games and is now on the market for other temporary events. And that's a great advance in technology, which opens new opportunities for you can create great, interesting shapes of it. We used huge inflatable cushions to form the roof. With a low-pressure air pump. And that's the sort of thing you probably wouldn't do on a permanent building, but it's something which you can create real dynamism and excitement on a temporary structure.
So, David, let me just ask you briefly, when Dave Morley Architects then are looking at a project which is for a temporary structure, is there a difference of approach in terms of how your teams are briefed, how they prepare, and the sorts of considerations that they make? Or is it it's absolutely the same, it's interchangeable, whether it's going to be there for maybe a matter of days, for example, at a sort of a big consumer electronics show, for example, or for decades as a more permanent structure?
It's a very different approach. It's really working closely with industry and looking at what are the components that are available, what can we make which could be reused. And I think a great new thing which we developed for the Olympic Games is the idea of pre-cycling. So what that means is making your building out of components which already exist. So, for example, in the water polo venue for the Olympic Games, 75% of the structure was components which were already in the supply chain, which we simply bolted together in a new way, a bit like Lego or a Meccano set. And so to get that right, you really need to understand what's available in the industry supply chain and to exploit that to the best advantage.
Fascinating insights, David. Thanks so much for joining us. That was David Morley from David Morley Architects, and you should head to their website. You can see some extraordinary pictures of some of their great projects there and look at it in more details. Thanks to David for joining us here on The Briefing. That's just about all we have time for on today's edition of the show. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Gaia Lutz, Benoit Grogan-Avignon and Henry Rhys Sheridan. And our studio manager was Joel Church. Stay tuned on Monocle 24. The Atlantic Shift follows next. Gaia Lutz will be in the chair bringing you her pick of tracks from our global playlist. The Briefing, of course, returns at the same time tomorrow. If you needed a reminder, that's noon here in London. For today's Monday edition of the programme, though, And from me, Tom Edwards, that's all we've got time for. Goodbye.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24. 24.